All right. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House of the Rising Sun with Lynn and Bruce Rawls. Bruce Rawls, good morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Lynn and all. I'm great. And yourself?
I'm great as well. Bruce, do you have something for us this morning to look at? Did you send it to me in email and I haven't seen it yet?
I just posted it in the chat window, in the Skype window. I was thinking 1188, which is actually just the very next one after the one we read last week.
Well, that makes
it. And FAQs might be a good candidate. There seems like there's a lot of substance there. And this is the frequently asked questions from the facimoutreach.org, which you can get to from facim.org, the Foundation for A Course in Miracles website. And there's just so much wonderful stuff there.
Okay, could you repost that link? Because I'm not seeing it.
Oh, okay, sure. Let's see if I can grab it here. Oh, I see. Call started. Yeah, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah, because you restarted the recording, probably restarted that too. Can you see it now?
Oh, okay. So there we go. I got, yes, I do. So now I'm going to post it in the room so people will know where we're reading from. And then I'm going to post it in my browser.
The technical issues are out of the way first.
I know. Yep. Then I'm going to post it in my browser. And boom. Says, there it is. Isn't that? I love the magic of technology.
All mirrors of our mind, huh?
It is, and boy, it's, you know, if it's a reflection of our mind, if what we see in the world is a reflection of our mind, and you know, here we have established this incredibly intricate method for communication as a to try to make up for the fact that we're incapable of actual communication, and. And so we made this elaborate thing called the internet, and we've supported it with satellites that are surrounding the earth, and you know, we've done everything to bring all this information from outside in, and you know, the fact it's all it's an inside job.
It is, and that's really wonderful. It's a great insight that you just shared there, Lynn, because it's, you know, it really is amazing how the lengths that we've gone to try to, you know, bring in what seems to be outside, inside, and yet they never left its source.
So it's just it's so crazy, and when you think about it, you know, it shows that we have a deep desire to become connected. And, you know, you look at the history of man from, as far as we know, the beginning. Really, what has man tried to do? Go out and reconnect. Travel all over this globe trying to reconnect. Travel outside of this globe trying to reconnect. Now we're going to start traveling to other planets trying to reconnect. The whole thing is an attempt to reconnect to our true source. And again, as we go out and out and out, we find that there's only more and more and more that we need to do to get what we already have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy. So
as you're thinking about it, I was thinking about some of the what would be called conspiracy theory things that talk about prior civilizations on Mars and you know, which is just an extension of the prior attempts that we've made over countless millennia on this planet to, you know, just if we can kind of look at our egos and then the real self that we all have and those two thought systems and the constant ambivalence and equivocation and battle between those two that seems to happen in the mind, and yet they're just, you know, the history books are full of, you know, the epics of those that resistance that we have to what we really are, as we, you know, tend to identify with who we think we are, and the who, you know, continues its conquest of others, whereas the what we really are, you know, quietly waits for us. The general recognition that, you know, what we really are is all one, and we get there by seeing shared interest and sameness, and it's fascinating, isn't it? When you think of, and I was thinking, reflecting this morning, you know, a little bit on the past couple of weeks, watching a fair amount just at, for, I'm not sure if it's morbid curiosity, mostly of the political conventions and both of them, and just seeing both the contrasts and the similarities, and yet at the same time, seeing how, you know, again, no matter where we come from, if it's trying to you know, fix the dream, it's all about, you know, thinking that somehow something is external, you know, which kind of starts off with the topic you led off with this morning.
Exactly. Yeah. And you said something really a curious turn of phrase that we use called morbid curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Morbid meaning death.
Right.
We're curious to death
about the
drama, and that is exactly what the ego does.
Yeah, it's the irony is that it is afraid of it, but is drawn to it, and that's the insanity of the ego is it really wants it's to be self-extinguished because it can't stand itself, you know, and that's the unconscious guilt which manifests in any time that we have issues with other people or with ourselves or just basically are selfish. And one of the audios I was listening to this week of Ken Wapnick's material was, you know, that we may not always see the unconscious guilt in a way that's just obvious in those terms, but whenever we look at our selfish behavior and the motivation behind that, more importantly, and see how insane that is, and can watch it objectively, that helps us uncover and reveal to us the depth of the unconscious guilt that we're healing with our forgiveness classroom here. And I think so. That's I think a really helpful tool of just looking at the insanity of you know, wanting to have my interests be well, I'll use a verb that seems timely, to trump your interests.
Oh, how
pun intended.
Ironic. Oh my God, it's an ironic, you know, that's just
but any political party is partisan, and we're all partial to our finite selves when we invest in our ego strategy of me first. You know, it's more about me, whether it's a party or a country or a planet. I mean, you know, at some point, you know, when extraterrestrial contact is more common and more widely accepted by the masses, which already there's a growing belief that, you know, maybe we're not the only sentient beings in the dream universe, you know, then there'll be the we versus they will shift to, you know, planetary and then galactic battles, you know. I mean, that's why the Star Wars epics are so appealing, because we realize that, you know, this doesn't, it's not limited to just the planet. We made up a whole cosmos,
mm-hmm.
To escape from the unconscious guilt, and but we made it out of duality with duality. And how crazy is that, huh?
Exactly. Because we made it with the purpose being that to attack. I mean, that's really the whole purpose of creating or making this world, is an attack on God, and it is and so everything that we make here is a continuation of the attack, mm-hmm. unless we are turning it over to the Holy Spirit and using it for the purpose of awakening ourselves to the truth and accepting the atonement and practicing forgiveness. Every single thing we're doing is an attack. So it's the purpose that we give it. And I know that sounds like harsh words, but man, it's not. And you know, my I guess emphasis on this and my desire to really look at unconscious guilt. I'm actually writing a book now.
Oh, great.
And the book is called Love Makes No Exceptions: The Prime Directive.
All right. I'm a big fan of the Prime Directive.
The Prime Directive, because the Prime Directive says that any sentient species, and that to me means anybody and anything, because, you know, we don't know the sentience of anything. we are only aware of our own sentience and a few other things, but we don't know the actual nature of anything. But Jesus tells us that everything is the sum of creation is the sonship. And, you know, even this bastardized creation that we call our universe is still the sonship. Mm-hmm. And, so
seemingly fragmented.
Seemingly fragmented. So if the prime directive says the right of each sentient species is to live in accordance with its normal cultural evolution, and that is considered sacred, and no Starfleet personnel may interfere with the healthy development of an alien life and culture, to me, that prime directive says, Lynn, what happens with anything that appears to be outside of yourself is not your business.
Right.
You're not in control of it. It's not your business. You can't tell it. This includes the people you love, the people you hate, the world, the politics, everything. You're in no position to tell it what to do. Or to judge it.
Yeah.
You know, the prime directive is really love everything, love all with the respect that it deserves, mm-hmm. as a being and as right. a holy son of God.
Exactly. To appreciate and accept the essence that's behind and seemingly hiding within all the seemingly separate people and objects and aspects of what we call creation here.
Yeah. So the prime directive to me is, you know, I can't judge or interfere with anybody or any other thing. And so what is the basis of my whole, relationship with the people, the world, you know, everything is that of complete respect and non-judgment.
Yeah.
And total positive regard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, now when I look at how my actions and reactions work in the world, I look for the cause of, you know, why I would do anything else other than to totally love and respect each individual creation, if you want to call it that. The only reason that I would is because I judge it to be less than or imperfect or fearful, or, you know, I have all these judgments, and all those judgments are based on that very basic, deep, unconscious guilt that if I can go back and look at that in every instance and recognize that that's the source of these feelings and these thoughts, then I give up trying to interfere. I give up trying to change. I give up trying to make anything different than it is. And I begin to go within for the answers. I begin to seek within for the answers. So, you know, I think it's cool. It's all going to tie in real well. And I might, if I can, possibly use examples from things like that I love, like Star Trek,
mm-hmm.
and other movies and TV shows that actually show that we are actually one thing. And we're just we're just thinking that we're something else. So anyway, we'll see how that goes. But now let's go.
That sounds like a good topic. One more thought on that before we dive into the FAQ, and that's a little numerical thing that I ran across that I put into my second book that's I think kind of fun, and that is that it's half the effort to be responsible to everyone as it is to be responsible for everyone. And with a play on words on the numbers 2 and 4. And if you think about it, you know, that's the level of confusion is thinking that we're responsible for someone or something implies that we need to fix the dream. And that's just classic level confusion, isn't it? But if we're responsible to, that means we can afford to be kind because we're not invested or have attachments to the outcome, one way or another, of what something in our reflected dream world does or doesn't do, because we realize that playing with the screen, you know, whether it's, the captain of the Enterprise looking at the screen that is appearing on the in front of the bridge, or it's us in front of our computer screen, or the windscreen, if you will, of our cars as we're driving around, or whatever we happen to be doing or experiencing, it's the mind screen that is. You know, that windshield is really just a reflection, as is the instrumentation of whatever we're looking at, you know, whether it's a computer keyboard or a car's dashboard or whatever. I mean, it doesn't matter. Those are all just reflections of choices we've made in the mind, and they can be symbolic reminders to get back to the mind if we choose that thought system. But
oh, beautiful. Yeah. That's beautiful. I might steal that 2-4 thing from you.
Oh, sure. Please do.
You know, that, because that's exactly what, I mean, talking about the Prime Directive, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're responsible to, but we're not responsible for.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The you know, whatever the state of the world and whatever your state. And I think, you know, what I began to see very clearly is that Jesus is pointing out to us in this course that we do a great disservice to our brother when we judge him as being anything less than whole. Right. So if we look at our brother and we think, well, he's not capable of understanding this, or, you know, they're look at these ISIS people. These are barbarians, and they're doing things that are, you know, completely unacceptable. They're beneath. You know, being human, they're not even, you know, human the way that they act. You know, you think these thoughts, you know, I've thought these thoughts when I've read about some of the horrible, horrific things that they've done. And what that does, that judgment in itself takes away the responsibility of that person for their own personal life, and actually makes of them a character, a cartoon character, rather than the whole being that you know, I think that I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing them as less than I am. I'm seeing them as different than I am. And every time I look at them and see them in that way, I'm adding more and more and more to the gap, the separation, because I'm rejecting all of them. I'm not just rejecting the behavior that I don't like. I'm throwing out the whole party. I'm throwing everything out and saying none of it is worth anything. And so I'm devaluing my brother. And when I devalue my brother, I devalue myself.
Right.
I'm doing the same. Whatever I do to you, I'm doing the same thing to myself. And it may not seem evident to the conscious mind, but in the unconscious mind, there's hell going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's complete and total hell, and no wonder we're so miserable, because all of these judgments, and in fact, here's a quote from text chapter 3, the strain of constant judgment is virtually intolerable.
Intolerable, yes.
It is curious.
Okay. I love that quote.
Yes, I think this is one of yours too. It is curious that an ability so debilitating would be so deeply cherished.
Uh-huh. Yep, that's it. Mm-hmm. But we do. I mean, because we think that somehow our judgments are going to save us, but that's only because we've invested in an identity that's false, in a world that's false, and yet we can use that exact classroom, the perfect mathematically generated opportunity of in our unconscious mind to get back to the choice point in the mind, the decision-making faculty that can say, wait a minute, I could see peace instead of this. I could choose to see the people and the groups that I don't agree with as expressing calls for love rather than, demonizing or in some way degrading or diminishing or elevating, whether it's, doesn't matter if it's special love or special hate, or whether it's
same thing.
whether it's a difference that's greater than or less than, doesn't matter. I mean, because we can idolize and our celebrity culture, whether it's a political figure, a movie star or a sports figure, you know, it doesn't matter. Anything that we elevate as well as demean, or sometimes it's both, you know, sometimes we say, well, I like this about this person, but I hate that about the same person. You know, it's like, well, okay. In either case, if there's a judgment or a condemnation involved, that makes a difference, a big deal. Obviously, we can certainly notice things that are factual without being upset by them. And I think that's the critical thing, is if we find ourselves getting upset, and political years are, you know, election years are such great classrooms for that, is just watching the contents of our mind and seeing, okay, when have I been either moved to tears or to anger or to whatever, and just noticing that without condemnation, say, am I making a big enough deal out of this that I'm choosing that experience over my peace? And that can be hugely helpful, can it?
Oh, that's absolutely helpful. If
yeah.
you recognize that you're doing it, and you recognize that you don't have to do it.
Right.
And here's the other thing, is that people feel compelled because they think that there's such a thing as right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And let me tell you, there's no such thing as right and wrong when it comes to behavior. There's no single behavior that is more acceptable to God than any other behavior, because God doesn't recognize or even know about behavior. Can you imagine that? God doesn't know behavior, because behavior is a reflection of the separated mind, and all behavior is caused by the separated mind attempting to compensate for the loss of heaven. So, you know, any emphasis on behavior is going to be misguided.
Mm-hmm.
For if you believe in this particular kind of thought system, and I'm not saying to people, you know, don't look at your own behavior, because it's my own behavior that is the reflection of the thoughts that are in my mind, and that behavior is going to either be that of peace or that of destruction. And even people who think that their behavior is one of peace, do not, you know, if you're focusing on one thing or another, and let's just talk about things like Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi, who were both, you know, they're advocating peace, advocating equality, advocating, you know, social change that was going to bring about the restoration of equality, which was both of their basic topics, was the restoration of equality. And yet, in order to restore equality, there had to be some, you know, there's got to be some good guys and some bad guys. And there's always, I mean, it's just a play of duality throughout all of it. None of it is truly helpful, because really it just points out and causes more division. However, in the scheme of the world, in behavior and social change and culture, it's going to have good, what we call good, and what we call tragic. And look at all the tragedies that came about because, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. or Mahatma Gandhi decided that they wanted to make a change in the culture, through the culture, and, you know, that brought about violence, that brought about war, you know, basically people were murdered, there was, you know, all sorts of terrible things that happened, and it's a, you know, and eventually there were strides. You know, they did kick the British out of India. I can't say that India is any more peaceful of a place or more equality of a place now than it was then. I can't say that America is more peaceful or more equality. You know, there are some places or in some instances where that may be true, but in general, it just, when you try to do things in the world, it is haphazard at best, and the actual result is, you know, nobody can say. I mean, nobody really can say, even at this moment, what the actual result of any of those things were, because it's not done yet. We're still doing it. But, you know, what if instead of doing those things, they had actually gone within and seeing the source of the actual inequality, and worked on that source, worked on remembering that source and remembering why unconscious guilt and all those things that were keeping us from being at peace, what kind of a movement would that have made? And I looked to Jesus, who was a nonviolent. He didn't advocate social change. He didn't say, let's go march on Rome. He didn't say, let's fight the occupiers. He didn't say, let's go for independence. You know, he said, you know.
He probably didn't even belong to the People's Front of Judea or the Judean People's Front. Huh?
Neither of those. That's right, Brian. But look at, okay, and of course there's results of all types that came from that. But in the end, the legacy of Jesus still remains, and people all over the world still look to it as a guideline for how to live. And, you know, you know, that guideline for how to live stands true even today. And that guideline was not nonviolence, non-interference. You know, basically he said, you know, give to Caesar what Caesar's, don't mess around with this stuff, and really go within. And that still remains. And we still have people like, you know, I listened to a lot of Joel Goldsmith, who became enlightened from reading the Bible and the talk of Jesus and following Jesus' example and doing what Jesus did, not doing what the apostles and everybody else did. And so, you know, and I see that and I say, that is a message that stands true. If a person in, you know, 2,000 years later can read it and become awakened from it. And like I said, you know, what kind of world do you want to live in and how do you make that change? Well, if you make the change within and you actually then begin to respond from that place of surety and confidence and trust, then that knowing that God is with you and in you, then the way that you walk through the world is much, much different. And you make an effect that you don't even, you know, Jesus says, you know, you have no idea when you do these things. It's affecting people all over the world, and it is collapsing time for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, you know, all that politics is just morbid entertainment, morbid curiosity.
Well, but I also at the same time see, you know, and I'm just as, you know, a personal, you know, aside is that I was watching, you know, some of the speeches this last week, for example, and seeing the form of inclusion expressed as an ideal, and the form of you know, not leaving anyone out of the dialogue, and I think that was actually very inspiring to me, and at the same time recognized, but it's not about the behavior. It's never about the behavior. It will usually and often does reflect in behavior that we would label kind or generous or helpful, but there could be actions that don't look anything like that. That could be because, you know, again, we don't see the mind directly. We see reflections of it, and so, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in worshiping the finger instead of where it's pointing to. You know, to use another cliche, but I think it's a good one because it you know, helpful one because it reminds us that the right and wrong behavior is just a flawed concept from the get-go, whereas the right mind versus the wrong mind, while it sounds moralistic or judgmental, if we use it in the context that I think the Course intends it, only because language is so limiting, it doesn't have any – the right mind of the Course, as contrasted with the ego, doesn't have any judgmental quality to it if we get to the heart of what's meant by those words, not the words themselves. But that right mind is basically the quality wherein we remember to forgive ourselves for having projected a dream of separation, and we forgive the dreamer, and that's where we let everyone else off the hook, because there's no one out there that is worthy of condemnation, and we can afford gratitude for everyone for bringing us back to that right-minded choice, where we use the illusion of forgiveness to undo our identification and our belief in all the other illusions that seem to be plaguing us or demonizing us in a morbidly bizarre way at times. Anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, it's all about the mind. So let's take a look at our question.
Yeah, sure. We've meandered a bit, but I think that might be a good preface, and it always ties in somehow or another, right? Do you want to read the question?
Sure, because I think this does tie in.
it has to. I mean, everything's interconnected.
Everything is interconnected, and everything. Oh, and that's the other thing. I'm doing two books at once. Believe it or not.
Cool.
The second book that I'm doing is the Tao Te Ching, and A Course in Miracles.
Uh huh.
So I'm going through the Tao Te Ching and showing how A Course in Miracles says the same thing and explains actually what is said in the Tao Te Ching. So
I'm eager to read both.
Good. Well, there you go. At least I've sold two books, or maybe I'll have to give to you if you're my buddy. I don't know. But thank you, Sharon says this will be a great book. Thank you so much, Sharon. Well, it looks like I'm going to be having time to do some writing pretty soon. So, but that's what I need to talk to you about afterwards.
Okay.
So my former, this is question number 1188. I'm going to post it again in the room in case some folks came in that didn't get the original post. Here we go. And okay, and 1188, by the way, is a really good number to me. It's
it's two nines if
it's
you do
two nines.
Numerological stuff on it.
And two nines is 18, and 8 and 1 is 9, so it's a 9 number all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, but it also follows 1187, so, you know, you can't give it that much credence. Anyway. And it's 1189, which is a whole different set of numbers. So
the blindingness of form.
I'm going to cough because I'm laughing. All right. My former religious education has oriented me towards the idea that as one sows, does one reap. You reap what you sow. However, the idea of a consequential relationship with our behavior is absent from A Course in Miracles. It's about behavior. One is only required to forgive, and our actions, good or bad, are only illusions, which do not exist. But if it follows that the Course instructs nothing regarding behavior, why would forgiveness, okay, fundamental confusion, why would forgiveness be an important element, as forgiveness is applied towards imagined wrongs or sins or errors committed? Finally, if there is no reality of behavior, how can there be forgiveness for what never happened? Well, I think you just answered your own question.
Mm-hmm.
Ignoring the matter may seem more accurate. So they're saying, they're thinking Jesus is proposing that we ignore the matter.
Russian
shrug.
Not quite. Should I read the first paragraph and the answer?
Sure. This is perfect.
It is. I think it ties in greatly to what we were just talking about. So, okay, the first paragraph of the answer provided in the FAQ number 1188 from the FACMOutreach.org forum is, the questions you raise may make sense within the context of your former religious education, but the course begins from radically different premises, and its teachings can only be understood and appreciated when we recognize that it is saying something very different from nearly every other spiritual teaching the world has to offer. And it gives some examples of chapter 18 in the text, section 7, paragraph 4, 5, and 6. While the Course, it is true, is not concerned with behavior, it is very concerned with thought, which is the source of all perceived behavior. And then three more references there. It is our thoughts, not our actions, that the Course asserts have consequences. And a couple more references to both the text and the workbook. So while the Course may not say that we reap what we sow in terms of behavior, it implores us to recognize that our thoughts produce very definite experiences within our minds. And then they reference workbook lesson 132 there, paragraph 1 and 2. And that there are really only two categories of thoughts, right-minded thoughts and wrong-minded thoughts, each with an outcome diametrically opposed to the other. Well, it does sound like this ties in beautifully, doesn't it? And again, the right-minded is only right in the sense of returning us through forgiveness to the awareness that, that separation and duality was just a silly idea. It wasn't evil. I love how Ken Wapner, I just listened to that again in one of his audios the other day. In fact, it was on C.A. Brooks's program. She, by the way, if anybody is interested on 1-2 Radio Friday mornings, it's currently at, I think it's 10 a.m. Pacific. They just moved the time. C.A. Brooks, who's also in the Denver area, has a wonderful program on A Course in Miracles every Friday morning on 1-2 Radio. And so this is where I heard it again on one of Ken's audios, where Ken says, it's not evil, sinful, or wicked, you know, referring to the ego. It's silly. It's that whole thought system is of sin, guilt, fear, death, and morbidity. It's just silly. It's basically investing in an idea that there could be something that's wrong. There could be something that's inappropriate or unkind or unhappy or in any way out of kilter with perfect peace and or innocence that we all truly are. Do you want to read the next paragraph?
Absolutely. And it just is amazing to me that I did not look at this before. So
I didn't either. I just figured, well, it's the next one I hadn't read. So, but yeah.
Yeah, it's perfect. So, so the course's focus is on the mind because from its perspective, the world is nothing more than a dream. Okay. So we're looking at the dream. All right. Consider that while you sleep at night and dream of vicious attacks and cruelties perpetuated by other figures against you or your loved ones, you may desire vengeance or seek to make others pay for their destructive actions within your dream. But once you awaken, or if you know you are dreaming while you remain asleep, you understand that seeking to hold any of the figures in your dream accountable for their actions makes no sense. And is really quite silly. There's that silliness.
Sounds like a violation of the Prime Directive, too.
It is a violation of the Prime Directive. Exactly. Exactly.
But yet no one was harmed in the making of that movie, right?
Exactly. There are no real figures doing evil to others, but only thoughts or symbols within your own mind, interacting according to the script your own unconscious mind has written. The problem is not with the symbols in your dream, but with the thoughts within your mind that lie behind the symbols you seem to be experiencing. You would readily recognize, if you knew you were dreaming, that the only meaningful choice is between continuing to dream and awakening. That's it. That's the only choice. To be concerned with what does or doesn't happen with the figures within your sleeping dream is only to continue to indulge in fantasy for your own apparent amusement and entertainment. And that's it. It's all for my amusement and entertainment. That's the reason that I keep seeing the same stuff over and over and over again, because I like it and I want to see it. And that is a huge thing to understand. If you ever come to the point where you recognize that even when you're looking on the most horrific thing, the thing that is just tearing your heart apart, the thing that is, someone you love has died or is dying and your heart is breaking because of it, look at that and see the amount of entertainment you're actually getting out of this emotion and looking and thinking about this emotion and thinking about how bad you feel and thinking about how you're going to tell everybody else about how bad you feel and how everybody else is going to be so sad for you and give you so much love because you feel so bad. And, you know, it's total insanity. Mm-hmm. That is looking at, this world and enjoying the drama of it, having that morbid fascination for the drama, the upset, the fear, all of that. What that does, and you'd ask anyone who goes out and does, paragliding, or, you know, jump out of airplanes, or, you know, what is it that brings them so much excitement and joy about it? It's this feeling of being alive, because it's being juxtaposed with this possibility, potential of being killed or horribly injured. And when you have that feeling of, you know, I'm overcoming this terrible, fearful thing, you know, the fear is still in your heart, but you're overcoming it and doing what you're doing in spite of that, it gives you a feeling of exhilaration, and actually it causes adrenaline to come up in your body, and your body starts feeling this exhilaration. It makes you feel alive. That's what people, when they drive too fast, you know, they're putting themselves in danger. It makes them feel alive because they're juxtaposing their experience to the potential mayhem of, you know, if something went wrong. So this is entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know, what he's saying here is an entertainment. To be concerned with what does or doesn't happen with the figures within your sleeping dream is only to continue to indulge in fantasy for your own apparent amusement and entertainment. The Course is inviting us to generalize this recognition to our lives in the world, which the Course refers to as our waking dreams. So in this waking dream, I am trying to make myself feel alive. Yeah. And every experience that you have from, you know, again, you know, those kind of experiences that take you close to death, those kind of experiences that bring you to the heights, like, you know, sex and, you know, passionate lovemaking, orgasm, all that kind of stuff. All of that is trying to bring into the dream a level of joy that's going to overcome the fact that you actually feel like you're dead, because you're not experiencing your truth, your spirit. You're not experiencing your connection with God, and you're not experiencing your connection with your brother. And that experience is so beautiful and amazing that when you do experience that, then all those other experiences, those thrills and chills, have no meaning to you once you've experienced the love of God. Yeah. Once you experience that connection.
Yeah. As you're speaking the last minute or so, Lynn, I was thinking about the phrase triumph over. You know, that any time we have that going through our mind, that's usually a tip off that the ego's, you know, gotten back into the driver's seat again, and we've kicked the Holy Spirit out and our inner kindness teacher, because if love makes no comparisons, then what is there to triumph over, including our own personal challenges? You know, and even, you know, you see documentaries on TV or on the web or, you know, examples of, you know, personal triumph, and not to diminish any of those or to suggest that we shouldn't do those. But I think if we can look at what's going on in the mind, and if we're basically trying to, maybe on some unconscious level say, hey, look, God, I don't need you. I can do this on my own. I can have these personal triumphs. You know, whether it's food, sex, drugs, rock and roll, or you know, hang gliding, or whatever. I mean, it doesn't really matter the specific, or it could be, you know, a technical problem. It could be anything. I mean, just anything that we think, oh, I figured this out on my own. It's that John Wayne ethic that is basically, you know, I'll do it myself kind of thing. And yet that really never brings us any peace. So I think there's nothing wrong with all the things that we do in the dream world, but it's I think the idea of the Course is, and if we're, you know, purporting to be students of the Course, it behooves us to look at the contents of our mind and say, wait a minute, maybe I use this entertainment, if you will, to get me away from my mind, which is where the real lasting peace is that goes beyond the seemingly happy dreams and alternating with nightmares that never seem to have an end. And yet we know that there's an end to it if we just remember to look at the contents of the mind again and see that there's a peace behind all the polarization. Shall I read the next one?
Yes, please go right ahead.
Okay. Third paragraph here says, what lies beneath your question is the belief that we must all pay for our sins, and it is an unfair universe where people can get away with murder. Well, we might want to include politicians in recent, you know, current events, you know, or anything that include really, which is our reflection. One thing years ago, I saw Merv Griffin had Maharishi Mahesh Yogi on his show, and he was talking about, you know, the political scene then back in, you know, what was that, 70s, 80s, whenever it was anyway. And this is a long time ago. I remember watching the show, and it struck me that, you know, people were complaining about the whole political system and how corrupt things were and how it needed to be overhauled and so forth. And Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, interviewed by Merv Griffin, said, well, this will continue as long as we don't look at the fact that this is what we want, and it's the contents of our minds that's just being projected out. And I'm paraphrasing greatly, but that was kind of the gist of what he was saying. And the audience was just dumbstruck because it's like, wait, what? Huh? Wait, what? Where? Because we don't want to look at the contents of our own minds, because we think that there's still some kind of investment or some kind of payoff, whether it's entertainment value or whatever, that we're going to get from level confusion and from investing in that kind of resistance. Okay, I'll continue. It says, but if there really is no one other than myself, then to hold on to that belief and desire for earthly justice means I've been hoodwinked by the ego once again into wanting to make attack and grievances real, which keeps the dream of separation real in my mind and keeps me apart from God's love. Forgiveness is never for anyone but myself. It can never be a matter of ignoring my experiences and calling that forgiveness. For my experiences always reflect what teacher I have chosen within my own mind. So it's not about denial or ignorance. And when I believe I can simply ignore my own choices, I am secretly choosing the ego with all the unpleasant consequences that follow from that choice. Sin, guilt, fear, and all their various expressions in form. Any comments on that paragraph, which was loaded?
Well, you know... I don't know if I have anything about that. I just don't get it. What are you saying here? This makes no sense to me. What? Which is really, honestly, when I'm looking, yeah, if you know, I remember that when the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was on Merv Griffin. It was back when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched Merv Griffin every day. I would go home from school, and me and my mom would sit and watch Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas and all kinds of, you know, that stuff was real popular. I don't even know if they have those kind of shows on anymore. But the idea even then of, you know, what do you mean? You know, how can it be in my mind? It's obviously everybody else's mind is messed up, not mine. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, you have to actually come to a point at which you can recognize the power of your own mind and that you are the one who is thinking these thoughts. And no one else is making you think these thoughts. There's not a God that is putting thoughts into your mind or ideas. There's not a there's no one who's responsible for the thoughts in your mind. And in fact, for most of the thoughts that are in our mind are not even our own thoughts. And they're a part of the ego thought system. They're a part of the matrix. And, you know, that matrix is made to support this world as we see it. So it's going to say, yes, you're guilty. Yes, they're bad. Yes, you know, it's going to be very definitive about the definition of these things because it's the one who made it up and gave it to them. So it actually gave it the qualities that we perceive as guilty or bad or wrong or good or nice or kind. You know, these are all made up thoughts. Because even kindness is not necessary in the kingdom where there's no opposite. There's mm-hmm. there. It's a backward thinking. So
that'd be all there is.
That'd be all there is. Yeah.
I wouldn't need a name.
I wouldn't have a name. I wouldn't, you know, I need nothing. So, you know, if I'm responsible You know, that makes a huge difference. And I didn't know that I was responsible. I did not know that I was responsible for believing these thoughts. I wasn't responsible for making the thoughts up, because those are all the thoughts that are made to buoy the ego system and keep the world alive and running. But those thoughts are not my thoughts, and they're not necessary, and they're not helpful, and they don't do anything to show me what the cause of the problem is. And in fact, they lie to me about the cause of the problem. They misdirect me about the cause of the problem. And that is the ego's greatest skill, is that of misdirection.
Yes.
And the ego has this bait and switch kind of thing that says, you know, here I'm going to show you how to be a really good person, how to be a really kind person. And so you like, yes, I want to be good, I want to be kind. Well, the best way to do it is to judge everybody else as being not good and not kind. Because then when you look around the world and you say, there's nothing here that's good and kind except for me,
I can wear the face of innocence, which is only a facade if it excludes anyone else from that innocence. If it's real innocence, then it's you know, interpenetrates and is consistent through all of the sonship, and there's no one or no thing left out of that innocence.
That's right. The love makes no exclusions. Mm-hmm. And that's the prime directive.
Yeah.
Is that I don't look at anybody as being less than or different than myself, or anything being less than or different than myself. So I don't need to interfere with what you are, because you and I are the same thing.
Yeah.
And so
you said something a few moments ago, Lynn, that triggered an interesting thought that I hadn't really put together in quite this way before. And that is, you said no one is responsible for my thoughts or my happiness or something like that. And I was realizing, okay, well, yeah, that's true on the level of form externally, because there's no one out there, so no other person is responsible for what's going on in my mind. But at the same time, I'm as a separate self, as a fake identity, I'm not responsible for the little I is not responsible
no.
for my peace of mind either. In fact, that's the problem, is that the little I, the egoic self, thinks it is responsible, and therefore it thinks it is, you know, meriting retaliation for a crime that it never committed. And so that's why it's a fearful thought system, because it basically thinks it pulled off this cosmic crime, and yet nothing happened. So if that's the case, then the only responsible party is the decision making part of our mind, which, as you just pointed out again, you know, the ego is a master of diversion and you know, sleight of hand and basically getting us to look the other way, and when the reality of the choice in the mind as a decision making faculty is really the only thing that makes a difference, and that's where we ultimately choose forgiveness as the way of undoing the ego's insane thought system.
Exactly. Yeah. And to looking at things and making that just instant judgment as to this is good and that is bad, this is right and that is wrong, this is what I want and that's what I don't want, all of those sorting things that we do in the mind that further separate and segregate, you know, all of that is unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not helpful.
Yeah.
And it puts us on, you know, we go through the world with a suit of armor on. We're trying to protect and defend ourselves, because all around us we see nothing but attack. It's because, you know, I've decided that is what I like and that is what I don't like. And so once I've done that, you know, I've set myself up, you know, to be disappointed at every level.
Mm-hmm.
And I will be disappointed at every level. That's one thing that the ego is consistent with. One day I was in the grocery, this is a while ago, so don't blame me now, but I was in the grocery store, and this lady cut me off in the aisle. You know, I was waiting to go into the checkout, and she came along and, you know, just jumped in there.
And you were in the fast lane?
Yeah, I was not in the fast lane, but it doesn't really matter, right? I mean, I would have let her ahead if she would have said something. I don't know. But anyway, she jumped in front of me, and I said, hey, you know, I was here. And she just gave me a dirty look, and I said, you know, because I was being whimsical, and sometimes I'm like that, you know, I said, you know, you can go through life acting that way, but right now I'm going to put a curse on you. The curse on you is going to be that everything you love is going to die. And
this is what you said to the lady in the grocery store?
Yes. Everything you love is going to die. And everything you want is going to crumble. And in the end, you are going to look back at your life and say, you know, what did I do all this for when nothing that I ever did worked? And I mean, that was a mean curse. But you know what? It wasn't a curse at all. It was just absolutely knowing, yeah, this is your life. You know, everything. I wasn't blessing her, believe me. But I wasn't making a dire prediction of something that I was thinking or hoping would happen. I knew everything you love is going to die. everything you cherish is going to crumble.
So what was the reaction of the lady in the grocery store when you said this?
She just gave me another dirty look and went, I was checking out, you know, probably thinking I was a, you know, whacked out, you know, whatever. However, I had just seen that movie, Thinner. Have you seen that movie Thinner?
No, I haven't.
It's Stephen King.
Oh, okay.
And,
I remember, I think it was actually...
Somebody does something you know, some guy does something, and this old gypsy lady who's the relative of the girl who was killed or whatever makes a curse on him. Mm. And he believed the curse, and the curse was thinner. He was a fat man, and she cursed him. She said thinner. And so he just started losing weight and losing weight and getting skinnier and skinnier, and he couldn't eat, and he couldn't, you know, he was wasting away because of this curse, because he believed what she said. And so I was thinking, I can curse somebody too. Anyway, that's a long time ago when I was another kind of person. But it's true. You know, you can curse anybody with that. And it will be true, and it will happen. And they'll think that you were evil and awful for doing that to them. But it's not me. I didn't curse you. You didn't, this is just the way it is in the ego world. So I've seen this. I see this now and talk, you know, he says hoodwinked here. Hoodwinked. I'm hoodwinked when I look at you and think that you are something different than me. I'm hoodwinked into thinking there's a separate being that is outside of me that is Bruce. And you know, the truth is Bruce is a character in the movie. And Lynn is a character in the movie. Yep. There is no real Bruce, and there is no real Lynn.
Pretty silly movie, huh?
It's a pretty silly movie. It's a pretty silly movie. Because in reality, we're just over here being the puppet masters and inhabiting the form and believing that we're in the story. But when we step back from that and we see, and we've all had, you've had instances of that, I'm sure, and you probably do it on a regular basis. I don't know. Stepping back from the scene and seeing it as if you were watching it from the outside. And I, you know, to do that in no matter what the situation is, if you can actually do that, step back from the scene and look at it as if you were looking from the outside, which I suggest and can suggest, you know, sitting in the movie theater with Jesus, eating the popcorn, watching it go on, no longer being invested in the emotion and the conviction of the story, and actually just looking at the story as if it is a story. It's not real, and it's not really what's happening. You get the freedom then to know that no one in the story is responsible for the choices in the story. You know, the guy chopping off your head is no more responsible for being there chopping off your head than you are being there getting your head chopped off. That is a part of the story, from which we are completely separate and not involved in any way at all. So we can watch the story and not be afraid because we know that nothing is really happening. But to get to the point where we're actually able to do that, this is why these 365 lessons of A Course in Miracles are so helpful, because they actually are a mind training. And if you do them to train your mind, you come to a point where you can look at all this and say, with conviction and honestly, this is not, no one has been harmed in the making of this movie. That's it.
Right. And that, I think the kindness and seeing the shared interests and moment to moment looking at our, the tendency that our egoic selves have to want to condemn others is hugely helpful to get us back to that lucid awareness that you're just describing, that I clicked into just as you're saying that. It's like, well, if we can look at the awareness that's beyond the dream of puppets and toys and, you know, wind up toys and cartoon characters, that our lives really are seen from the right perspective, you know, from a more transcendent perspective. I like the astronaut's perspective sometimes, even just, you know, our own planetary NASA program and the photographs that we get looking back at the Earth, you know, kind of like, wow, this is, I mean, everything that I've made such a big deal of has largely taken place on this one, a very small part of this one little continent in this little spinning sphere, you know, and this tiny little planet orbiting an average star in a you know, typical solar system. And it's like, wow, it's just crazy that I would make such a big deal out of this specific thing. But we're blinded by the form. We think that that's such a big deal most of the time. But we do get opportunities moment to moment to moment to see things differently and just to let go. Do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. And what you just reminded me of, too, and in fact, probably one of the first kind of wake-up moments that I had, and I don't even remember when this song came out, but I know I was driving, I was having some difficult time, and I was driving to work or from work or something, and this song came on the radio, and all of a sudden it just clicked for me, oh, this is what's going on. And it's a song called From the Distance with Bette Midler. And she's saying, from a distance, like from the satellite station or whatever, we all look the same. Mm-hmm. Can't tell the difference. That what appears to be horrific, you can't even see from the distance.
Right.
And then, you know, and she goes all about how everything is, you know, all sameness and nothing is really going on. And God is watching us from that distance. You know, God is watching us, and what he sees is the perfection of his Son. What he sees is the peace of God. What he sees is the joy of life. And he doesn't see the minutiae and the detail of what horrific things seem to be happening in the world.
Right. And the pure non-dual teaching of A Course in Miracles suggests that what we really are is outside of the dream of space-time. And so everything that we think of in terms of cosmology, and that was one of the things that was one of the big aha moments when I first read Gary Renard's books. How did I miss that going through the course? It's like, well, yeah, God has no – what we think – what the word that we use to define that all-encompassing awareness beyond the scope of this curriculum, which we – you know, as a convenient placeholder, use the word God, has no cognizance or no recognition of the dream. Because if that were to be so, then all bets would be off. All hope would truly be lost, because then there wouldn't be any reality to return to. If God's mind, if you will, had anything to do with space, time, or individuality, or ego's thought system of sin, guilt, and fear, that's where that GIST acronym, I think, is kind of helpful, you know, guilt, individuality, space, time. Then we would be in deep sushi. We would be in a world of hurt, only because that would mean that there's no perfection that to return to if the ego's lie was true, which it isn't. And that's where I think we can find great solace and great comfort, knowing that we're already home. And we're just dreaming of this exile, of the idea that we could possibly be separate and space and time could possibly exist.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And all hope would be lost then. I mean, all hope would be lost.
Yeah.
If there'd be no reason to have any hope at all if God was involved in this. So thank God he's not. That is one thing you can thank God for. You don't have to thank God for, you know, the light turning green when you're driving along, or you don't have to thank God for, winning the lottery or whatever. Thank God he didn't forget you and that none of this is true. That's the thing to thank God for. All right. So the next paragraph says, let's see. Are we on what ultimately?
I believe so.
Okay. What ultimately needs forgiving is our own decision for separation and not anyone's behavior within the dream, which we may have judged as bad or wrong or sinful. Yes, the Course says there is ultimately nothing to forgive because it's all a dream. But while we are too afraid of awakening, then having a non-judgmental attitude toward all that we are perceiving, let me start that sentence again because it didn't make sense. Okay. But while we are too afraid of awakening, then having a non-judgmental attitude toward all that we are perceiving, which is what the Course means by forgiveness, is the only way that we don't reinforce the reality of the dream in our own mind. Okay, so the Course means, what does the Course mean by forgiveness? Having a non-judgmental attitude toward all that we are perceiving. That's forgiveness. It's just not judging what you see.
Yeah, and not judgment in the perceptual sense, like saying, well, this is more green than that thing, or this is taller than that thing. It's not anything to do with the perceptual objective kinds of things that require perceptual discernment, but it's the interpretations that we give things that involve condemnation and blame and the wrath, if you will, of a crazy thought system.
Yeah. And even if we are quote unquote admiring another person or quote unquote loving another person, because that admiration and that love is conditional, based on, whatever behaviors or the time of the moon or, whatever that is, that's all those conditions are what make it, it's compromised. The love that we have is compromised. The acceptance that we have is compromised if it is based on any kind of condition. So, that then doesn't mean, I'm going to accept that nothing has gone wrong as long as I don't feel hurt, or as long as nobody else got hurt, or as long as nothing got broken. That's all conditional. And any kind of conditions that you put on it are going to, violate, but it's not really violate. It's just distilling the forgiveness. It takes the power out of it because you've given now a condition under which it can be given or taken away. My forgiveness is conditional, and so what he's saying is unconditional forgiveness, where I choose absolutely not to judge either way, right, wrong, good, bad, nothing, and just accept it as it is. And know that whatever it is a part of the plan for my salvation, and know that I am completely untouched by it, no matter what appears to happen. This is the basis for forgiveness, is that nothing ever happened and nothing can ever happen. So if there's any kind of condition to my forgiveness, that's saying I think something can happen. Something can go wrong.
And the ego is full of conditions and exceptions. In fact, it's a kind of metaphoric code of law is, bigger than all the amazingly complex myriads of laws that we have in this country and probably other countries as well. That, regulations and rules and laws and bylaws and trilaws and however many, exceptions that we make to perfect peace, or make it conditional. It's like, well, that's crazy making that we put all these constraints and limits on the things that we won't accept peace if such and such happens or doesn't happen, you know, whether it's a special love or a special hate situation.
Yeah, and exactly. And so the idea that love makes no exceptions, mm-hmm. you know, that love makes no exceptions, and that is the prime directive. You know, once you figure that out, then you're not going to look for guilt anywhere, and you're not going to look for you're not going to look for anything to go wrong. You're going to recognize nothing has ever gone wrong, and nothing can ever go wrong, and that is the basis for forgiveness. And you know, I mean, that's a justification for forgiveness. That's the thing that says forgiveness is the only sane reaction to what appears to be an insane world. It's my only function here, exactly. So let me continue with the paragraph. Let's see.
Okay. I think it's what Jesus describes.
Right, exactly. Okay. So Jesus describes this process in the Manual for Teachers. And quote from the Manual for Teachers, section 12, God's teachers choose to look on dreams a while. It is their conscious choice, for they have learned that all choices are made consciously with full awareness of their consequences. The dream says otherwise, but who would put his faith in dreams once they are recognized for what they are? Awareness of dreaming is the real function of God's teachers. Okay, so here's, you know, we just mentioned a function, this forgiveness. And now he's saying the real function is awareness of dreaming. Awareness of dreaming is forgiveness.
Exactly. you just read my mind, but that's because we're all heading toward the same mind, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So you want to go on and continue?
Sure, I'll read the next one. The last two paragraphs, the second to the last paragraph starts with, gradually, through that non-judgmental attitude of forgiveness, we release our investment in our own guilt and sense of sinfulness, which are the hidden motivating forces behind the dream, just as our own unresolved inner conflicts and guilt are the source of our sleeping nightmares. And as we release the guilt, the fear of awakening gradually subsides until that instant when we realize nothing matters except God's love, which is our and all our seemingly separate brothers' true reality. And that is, again, what we tend to want to skip over steps and go right to the love and the peace and the joy. And there's lots of curricula that suggest that we do that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But eventually we're going to, you know, and I say eventually with kind of a grin, because usually within a few split seconds, we realize that our resistance to that, and that's where the classroom really comes in so beautifully, is we notice where we fight that. We fight it tooth and nail, and to the extent that we're still invested in that ego self, that fake self that we made up, because we think we're getting some kind of payoff. We think we're getting some kind of reflection or reward, since this is about sowing and reaping, this whole FAQ, we think that we're going to get some payoff in the dream, which kind of ties back into the whole subject of level confusion. If as long as we think that there's something in this world that's going to make us happy, and if we can begin to just smile more frequently, inwardly, and sometimes externally, at that crazy notion, then we can begin to say to ourselves, wait a minute, I don't have to be subject to a dream scenario and a script that I made up on some level that I may not even be aware of, but I can just look at that with equanimity and with a great loving kindness and see that this is all a perfect unfolding of the undoing of ego and restoring my mind to its complete identification with everyone's right mind, which is synonymous with God.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, that's the purpose of all of this, the justification for forgiveness. It's the purpose of all of it. And and once you've had the experience, which if you have never had this experience, try it. Just practice it. Just practice.
Try it. You'll like it.
Just try it. You'll like it. Because, you know, you'll see that you can do it. And once I saw that I could actually do it, and you know, eventually came to the point where I recognized that it was my choice always to be in the fray or not. It was my choice always to, you know, there. I didn't have to act or react in the way that I did. I acted and reacted in the way I wanted to act and react in order to make a statement or to show how hurt I was or to show how angry I am or to show how happy I am or whatever it is. I'm choosing to act or react as a display to you as to how I think, what I think about what's happening. You know, if I don't like what you're doing, I'm going to be angry, I'm going to be sad, I'm going to cry, I'm going to be hurt, and I'm going to do everything I can to make you feel guilty for doing the things that you're doing. And, but on the other hand, if you're doing something that is wonderful, I'm going to find ways to look at my own self and see how I'm not doing as good things, or that you're doing good things, but you have a ulterior motive. You know, you're only doing this because you want to make money, or you're only doing this because you want, you know, people to love you. You know, there's not a single clean thought that you can have about another person or their behavior.
Are you saying I have a dirty mind?
You do.
But so does everyone. But fortunately, that mind doesn't exist. That's where we get off the hook, right?
That's where we get off the hook.
Yeah.
And to you know, you get off the hook when you recognize, well, heck, that couldn't be possible. That couldn't be true. And, you know, this person is equal to me and we're all the Son of God. Right. You know, if you can actually be able to say that, And try saying that with somebody that you're really mad at, you know, say you don't like somebody like, you know, Donald Trump or something. And you just like, oh, he is just the epitome of evil and, you know, the worst thing that ever happened. And he's going to ruin our country and we're all going down the, you know, whatever, you know, people are thinking, which they are thinking about both him and Hillary. There's not a single candidate that's being beloved by everyone because of that conditional state of mind that we're in. But, you know, look at the guy who's saying, I think Donald Trump's going to bring back America's greatness or whatever they're saying. You know, I used to have problems with that. Like, what makes you think America's not great? Or what makes you think America is great? Or what makes you think America was ever great? Or, you know, I mean, this is the madness of this.
It's all about separate interests, isn't it? And I just have to grin when you said the word candidate. I was thinking, well, the ego, special love, special hate, starts out with usually special love, which is sort of like a candy date, right? Something that's the sweet and then becomes sour. You know, it's like, wait a minute, you know, once you're a little further along in the relationship, you see more of your unconscious guilt reflected in that other person. And it's like, wait a minute, I don't like what I'm seeing here. And so that's usually how it goes with elections, you know, and you know, the dirt is uncovered, and which is basically, you know, the idea of dirt and cleanliness is tied into something with the notion of purity. And I was thinking a few years ago, I kind of clicked on it while I was putting the second book together about the seven hermetic laws. And one of the watchwords I put on one of the chapters was purity, which is for the law of polarity. And I was thinking, well, gee, if something is impure, it means that it has, that there's some parts of something that are different than some other part. Well, that's the whole, you know, essential, you know, paraphrased, of course, from, you know, the real idea in our minds that it kind of just defies words, but the idea of impurity is really has to do with something different than something else. You know, because you can't have, if something is pure, then it's consistent throughout.
Right.
Well, what is consistent throughout? Spirit. I mean, you know, essence, the quality beyond space and time that we all share. Well, that's pure. Everything else is a dream. It's just a silly dream. Like, again, like Kim says over and over again, it's not sinful, evil or wicked. It's just silly. It's just forgivable. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can give it up. And,
yep,
and once you decide to give it up, and start watching your mind for instances where you're violating your own integrity or your own purity, you begin to look over and over and over and see, ways that you can not do that. And every time you choose not to do that, it's like a bell rings and the angel gets their wings because it shifts the entire sonship. So so every time you choose to do it, the more often you choose to do it, the freer we become. Because it's all coming out of my own mind. So anyway, this has been great, Bruce. I truly enjoy my Saturday mornings with you.
Likewise, very much so.
Just a cool time with us. So,
thanks for everyone listening, and now and in the future.
Yes. And I'm going to actually stop the recording right now.